Well, good afternoon, everyone.
We've reached that point in the week when the exhaustion begins to set in. 4:20 on a Wednesday during convention. There's a lot that's been going on. Am I not coming through? Okay. Take it out. Okay. That better? On the crown of the mic.
Larry, do you know anything about the ALPs?
I can check the transcripts.
All right. Well, welcome to the 2015 convention version of the American Council of the Blind Legislative Seminar. I am your hostess with the mostest this afternoon. For those of you that don't know who I am, my name is Eric Bridges, and I'm the Director of External Relations and Policy with ACB. And so you're going to hear from me this afternoon, along with three other individuals. And along the way, there will be a little bit of time for Q&A. We're going to cover a variety of topics in the time that we have together. And before we sort of launch into to the topics that we're going to be covering today, I thought it'd be a good idea for volunteer extraordinaire and new life member of ACB, Bruce Radke, to go around. Yeah, give it up for Bruce. To take the mic around and see who's here.
Don Kors, Indianapolis.
Steve Fixdall, Washington State.
Kathy Brockman, Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Oh, Cynthia Cloud, Des Moines, Iowa.
Go Hawks.
Oh, yeah. Gretchen Mounty, Columbia, Missouri.
Chris Frickshaw, Westbury, New York.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Rick Vitrana, Boynton Beach, Florida. Okay, thank you.
Dan Dillon, Nashville, Tennessee.
Carol White, Dallas, Texas.
Adelie Lucas, Ewing, New Jersey.
Bob Lucas, Ewing, New Jersey.
Gene Lozano, Sacramento, California.
Teresa Curry, Gonzales, Louisiana.
Mary Lynn Pifo, Westerville, Ohio, just outside the capital, Columbus.
Carol McGee, Morgantown, West Virginia.
Loma Roads, Woodville, Illinois.
Paul Hunt, Austin, Texas.
Yeah. Cheryl Hunt, Austin, Texas.
Yeah. Alan Dunbar, Dallas, Texas.
Jose Rangel, Alamo Council of the Blind, San Antonio.
Sandy Edwards, Arkansas.
Charles Navarrete, West Covina, California.
Thank you. James Schwartz, Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm not the reason that it's so cold in here.
Alan Peterson from Horace, North Dakota, and I'm not responsible for the cold in here either.
Donna Hepper, Bismarck, North Dakota.
Adrian Van Note, Richmond, Virginia.
Julia Toyama, Honolulu, Hawaii.
Warren Toyama, Honolulu, Hawaii.
Hi, Warren.
Londa Falon from the state of Hawaii.
Art Cabanilla, also from Hawaii, but I guess we didn't bring enough heat with us.
Bless your heart. Karsten Everett, West Memphis, Arkansas.
Tamika Polk, Greensboro, North Carolina.
Shirley Marshall, Greensboro, North Carolina.
Michael Byington, various locations in Kansas.
Alias. Jan Gray, Fort Worth, Texas.
Charles Shavers, Austin, Texas.
Patty Timmerman, Austin, Texas.
Karen Campbell, Chicago, Illinois.
Okay. Larry to speak, but everybody else except the front table.
Okay. Why don't you hit the front table?
You want the front table?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Tony Stevens from in National Interest for the Blind in D.C.
Hello, everyone. This is Debbie Grubb, Florida Council of the Blind.
Good afternoon. Melanie Brunson, ACB Executive Director.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Bruce, and welcome, everyone. It's a group with a lot of geographic diversity. It's really cool, literally and figuratively. So... we've got a lot of different topics to cover today. For those of you that attend the legislative seminar, you are aware of our two legislative imperatives for the year, something known as the Alice Cogswell and Ann Sullivan Macy Act, which is our piece of special education legislation that we're seeking to have reintroduced, as well as H.R. 729, which is our low vision device coverage under Medicare bill that many in the community are quite excited about. And so those are imperatives, and we'll get to those. But we also have issues pertaining to the implementation of a little something called the CVAA, the 21st Century Communications and Video Accessibility Act. Some of that has been talked about at other seminars in the hotel this week, but we'll talk a little bit about that and how the implementation of the CVAA is going and what you can expect to see in the next 12 to 16 months or so. There was a major rulemaking that the blind community actively weighed in on for something called the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act that was passed last summer. And so the regulatory ball began rolling just within the last month or so. And we'll talk a little bit about that. Tony Stevens is up here with National Industries for the Blind. He's going to talk with us a little bit about that. We've got legal... advocacy update, as well as some international fund that should be coming to a U.S. Senate near us at some point. That Melanie Brunson will chat with us about, and then we'll spend a few minutes talking with an excellent advocate from a really great affiliate in Florida Council of the Blind, and Debbie Grubb. To sort of hear from her about the success that the Florida Council of the Blind has had in creating and maintaining and enhancing relationships with members of Congress in the state, because that's something that, you know, it's great when we see it, but I don't think that it gets highlighted or the affiliates don't get near the amount of visibility when it happens, because they're just doing their job, right? But I think we need to to begin to share more about the successes that, that we as affiliates have with regard to gaining and maintaining congressional champions for the issues that matter the most to us. So there you go. It's a packed agenda. If I don't fall asleep, we'll be good to go. Just throw a blanket on me. Wish me well if that happens. Pardon me?
I was telling Karen to check her
ALD. Oh, okay. Is it working? Okay. Excellent. Good deal. So why don't we get started? The Medicare Demonstration Project for Low Vision Devices Act of 2015, as you all are well aware, was reintroduced in February of this year. It was reintroduced by the same members that introduced it in the last Congress, Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney of New York and Congressman Gus Bilirakis from Florida, ironically, the Republican. In February, it now has 11 co-sponsors, which I would characterize that as a modest number. But when you look back on when it was introduced in the last Congress, we had 6 for the whole time. So we're doing much better, and we've got 3 Republicans signed on as co-sponsors, which we also did not have in the last Congress. So there is more visibility to this issue. This is one that, obviously, I don't need to tell you all. Our community feels very strongly that Medicare should cover devices that are not meant to restore your vision, but rather to augment or enhance the vision that you have left. And that Medicare's interpretation of the eyeglass exclusion, which is essentially they're saying anything that has one or more lenses in it, we're going to treat like eyeglasses and we're not going to cover, which is just ridiculous. We feel as though that the plan or the proposal set forth within this legislation is very, very reasonable, makes a lot of sense, and doesn't cost a lot of money. And by that, I mean less than $13 million, not with a B, but an M. It's like couch cushion coins for CMS. What do we need from you guys? Well, during the month of August, Congress goes home and they meet with constituents. They do town halls. They do all sorts of things within the community because their goal is to get reelected. Or at least that should be their goal. For you all to be able to go and talk with them about this issue, and for those of you that are low vision in the audience, to be able to take your video magnifier with you to not just talk about the bill and its impact on our community and why ACB needs it, but how it could impact you, people in your affiliate, friends, neighbors, family members, because all of that sets forth the reasoning and the rationale that they then would in turn have to sign on as a champion and co-sponsor the legislation. We understand that entitlement programs and bills that touch entitlement programs are not real popular on Capitol Hill right now. And in fact, I would argue the environment on Capitol Hill is very, 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 very hard. It's probably the hardest that I've encountered since I've been doing legislative and advocacy work, and I've been doing that for almost 15 years. And the challenge is that the Republicans don't get along with the Democrats. Obviously, the Democrats don't get along with the Republicans, and the White House doesn't get along with any of them. So the White House really has no relationship with either party right now, and so it's very difficult. And you can see some of that manifest itself by this whole trade deal that took probably far too long, and a lot of that had to do with the fact that the White House and the Democrat Party weren't seeing eye to eye, and a lot of it was because they weren't communicating. And so, unfortunately, on a lot of issues, that being one that's been pretty visible, none of the three are working particularly well. So, but that doesn't mean that we aren't up doing the work of ACB. It just means that we need to go about our business in maybe a slightly different manner. It's difficult when there is that sort of toxic atmosphere and you're bringing something that really costs next to no money that could benefit many, many people. But because it touches an entitlement program, people are less likely to sign on. So that's why we need you all. Because you live out in the States, your constituents, your potential voters. I can only do so much in Washington. It is my job to represent the interests of ACB to Congress and to the federal government and to corporations, and I'm proud to do it. But at the end of the day, I only have so much reach and so much credibility with some of these offices because I live in Arlington, Virginia. I've got credibility with my congressman in Arlington, though. He signed on to the bill, just FYI. So the ask here that I have for you all is to be active in the month of August. And wow. And be advocates. Get together with your affiliate. Map out a plan of action. If you need my assistance, please call on me. My email is ebridges@acb.org. The phone number in the national office is an 800 number, 800-424-8666. And we won't put you in, you know, Guatemala and Q or anything like that. It rings right to our office. But please do the vital advocacy work that needs to be done during the month of August. Not right now. The second bill is the Alice Cogswell and Ann Sullivan Macy Act, and you guys have heard us talk about this piece of legislation ad nauseum. It is a critical piece of legislation that would benefit the blind, low vision community, as well as the deaf and hard of hearing, and now deaf blind community. That is one change in the bill that has occurred since we last talked about it at the convention. And what we need here is a Republican sponsor. So a Republican in the House to join with Congressman Matt Cartwright of Pennsylvania, the Democrat, in introducing this piece of legislation. So here again, we have all of the background information for both the Cogswell-Macy Act and H.R. 729 on our website. I can send it to you. I'm happy to go and do follow-up meetings on the Cogswell-Macy Act or H.R. 729 after you've met with people in the district. Please just call on me. And I'll be there to provide whatever assistance I can. So these are two imperatives. These are issues that we need to continue to slog away at. As you all are aware, because many of you have been doing advocacy for many, many years, nothing ever worth having comes easy. And boy, it's true in the blindness community. But you know what? We have victories, and that's the one thing that keeps us moving forward, sane, and in a relatively good mood most of the time. So I urge you all to act in over the next month and a half. My email is ebridges, B-R-I-D-G-E-S, at acb.org. So we've got those two things. I think what we'll talk a little bit about next is still in the legislative realm, and we'll deal with the regulatory aspect of the implementation of the CVAA. Does everybody know what the CVAA is? Yeah, you got it. Exactly. So the 21st Century Communications and Video Accessibility Act, which was signed into law 5 years ago, and is going through sort of the last pieces of regulatory implementation, which is every bit as important, if not more important, I would argue, than the actual law itself, because this is informing industry how to comply with the law. And I have to say that the FCC, at our urging, obviously, but they have done a phenomenal job in implementing the various requirements, hitting all of their deadlines for releasing notices of proposed rulemakings and final rules. But so here's where we stand. In November, the emergency alert information will go into effect. The requirement to have that be made available, the crawl that goes across the bottom of the screen, you hear the tone, goes across the bottom of the screen, you have no idea what it says. Well, in November, you'll be able to access that information through the SAP function, like how you would access video description. And it will tell you what is going across the bottom of the screen, which is great. A little fact for you all, and I'm sure I've said this before, so I apologize, but you know the tone that happens before the crawl begins? That tone is a requirement by the FCC, and it came into being in the 1980s because they felt that blind people should know that there's an emergency. The irony is that we don't know what the hell the emergency is. So, we're finally going to crack the code here in November. Yeah, if you can get to the SAP channel. That's... Yes, it'll be the warning for Hurricane Floyd and Gilbert on the North Carolina coast from... But at any rate, that is one aspect that has been worked on by us as well as the National Association of Broadcasters. And actually, we've got what is turning into a decent relationship with the broadcasters now, which for those of you who are aware of the video description court case from 2002, they were very adversarial toward the requirement that the FCC attempted to mandate, and ultimately the broadcasters and the cable TV Association were successful in striking that requirement. And so the broadcasters were also not real helpful with the CVAA in the negotiations. But now things are changing, and we're happy that we're able to talk with them. And as a matter of fact, they were an Onyx sponsor at this convention. So thank you to them. Ironically, they sponsored the guide dog relief area. You can infer from that what you wish, but I smile every morning when Marjorie reads it. So, what else is going on? Well, you all are obviously very aware of what Comcast has done with voice guidance and the accessible set-top box and the technology that they've created, which is just tremendous. They are the industry leader, hands down right now. They did this a full nearly 2 years ahead of the requirement deadline. One of the things that we are actively engaged in right now at ACB is reaching out to the other cable providers and satellite providers, because we're not really hearing much from anybody else right now. We hear from a certain cable provider that, well, you know, our app is accessible. Well, that's fantastic if you've got an iPhone, but a lot of people don't. And you shouldn't have to spend a really significant amount of money on a phone to gain access to your TV. That doesn't make a lot of sense. So we're in late August going to be meeting with Charter Communications. I don't know how much you all have been following, but Comcast attempted to acquire Time Warner Cable, and that deal fell through. So now what is taking place is Charter Communications, which is the third largest cable provider in the country, is doing a deal to acquire, they're proposing to acquire, Time Warner, as well as Bright House Networks, which is big in the South, in Florida. If the deal were to be approved, it would make Charter the second largest cable provider in the country. And I believe the third or the fourth or fifth largest broadband provider. So big deal. And that's really what a lot of this is about. It's not necessarily about TV. It's about broadband and bandwidth and pipes and fun stuff. So that's what's going on. And so we'll be meeting with them in August after they file all their necessary documentation with various federal agencies to try and work this deal out. So that is that's something that all cable and satellite providers will need to comply with, this rule that Comcast has already complied with, by really December of next year. So what I would do if I were you is I would call your cable provider and urge them to get this done and get working on it. Let them know that the American Council of the Blind is concerned about this issue. And if you want, you can give them my contact information, because we would be happy to sit down and meet with them. So the question was asked, is there any particular person we need to work on talking to? That is like the $64,000 question, because every company is doing it slightly differently. Verizon does have a customer service center for people with disabilities, which is good. I would call them. Anybody that'll listen. So here's the thing, guys. We've got an individual up here that's using an assistive listening device. When we take questions, maybe we can get the mic around and all that. But we should be, and we're also streaming this live, so we should be cognizant of all that. Okay, I'll take a question.
Does the access to the warning about an emergency apply to people that get the signal over antenna?
Do you have access to the secondary audio program with antenna? I don't believe you do. Do you?
None of my remotes have SAP. Some in our area use NTS. Mine doesn't have that either, but I'll have to get a new TV or universal remote. I can do that.
Okay. Very good. Well, fantastic. Well, I think what we're going to do next is move to the discussion. Yes. I think it depends upon what your television will do. The capability of your TV. And here's the thing, guys. I'm happy to stay after for individual questions like that and chat with you all. So that's not a problem. The other thing that you all should be aware of is that as of July 1, the CVAA had the top 25 designated market areas covered for video description. So that means essentially the top 25 cities. But as of July 1, it moved from 25 to 60. So there's a whole bunch of cities that are now receiving over broadcast, you know, NBC, ABC, Fox, CBS, video description. Markets like Columbus and Las Vegas and Little Rock, Arkansas. There's a funny reason why. It's maybe not that funny, but it's kind of interesting. The reason why we moved from 25 to 60 is that former Senator Mark Pryor of Arkansas was one of the champions of this legislation. And when we were going through and doing some of the math to have video description expand, he represented, obviously, Little Rock, Arkansas, which is the biggest city in his state, and it was market number 57. And so he couldn't, in good faith, go from 25 to 50 and not have Little Rock included. So it went from 25 to 60. The other thing that you all should be aware of is that also as of July 1, there's a new top 5 cable channel ranking. And that means the CVAA says the top 5 cable channels as determined by Nielsen ratings need to have at least 4 hours a week of I do this all the time. 4 hours, each of them needs to do 4 hours of described programming a week. Okay, so the new top 5, and really there's only one that has been taken out. The new top 5 is USA, TNT, TBS, Disney, and then the new channel is the History Channel. So be on the lookout for described programming from the History Channel. The one that fell out is Nickelodeon. Nickelodeon has assured us that they will continue to describe the shows that they had been describing already. And so that is good news for us blind parents out there. So there's that. I think, you know, there are more opportunities for further description as well, for to move from 4 hours a week to 7 hours a week within the next year, which is pretty cool. That all is going to come from the commission. A lot of it is, you know, how we're accessing it and using it. And so I think, obviously, that is going to get much better as the requirement date for the user interface accessibility gets closer, because more companies will be putting out accessible products, which means we will be to independently access described content. So there's a lot going on with that. Within the FCC, there's something, a really neat event that took place a couple weeks ago that I was able to attend, as well as Kim and Brian Charlson and Carl Richardson and Joel Snyder and just a couple of other ACB members. It was something called the Video Description Roundtable. And it was hosted at the FCC, and the individuals that attended represented companies like Comcast and Netflix and CBS, as well as app developers, Yahoo, Apple, and others, as well as actual folks that provide post-production audio / video description, whichever you choose. It was a day-long meeting just to talk about video description. You guys, this has never happened in the history of the FCC, where they would put on a meeting like this where our issues didn't have to be considered alongside topics like closed captioning or other services for people with other disabilities. And that is not meant to be a shot at the deaf and hard of hearing community. Captioning, as well as the other issues that they have fought so hard for, have been in existence and prevalent a lot longer than ours have. And so to have this be singularly focused on video description, where is video description today? What's its history, and where do we see it going in the future? And now, what was neat, really cool about this meeting was that the companies around the table weren't all regulated by the FCC, right? Netflix is not regulated by the FCC. Neither is Yahoo. Neither were two or three other companies that were around the table. But everyone was interested in talking about the current state of video description and how description on television can move in an accessible way to the internet, to, you know, an original product on the internet like House of Cards. I thought that that snippet that they brought on Monday was really cool, by the way. The House of Cards. I don't know if you guys were in the general session or not, but it was really neat. You know, and being able to access that stuff is really, really outstanding. So there's going to be even more discussion about this because the FCC created something called the Disability Advisory Committee this year. And it's a 2-year committee, and we're members. ACB is a member of this committee. I represent ACB, and there are other folks that are like-minded that represent other organizations of the blind, for the blind, that are on there as well. And video description is a big topic of discussion, and that's it's fantastic to see. So, description, emergency alerts, the prospect of the requirement for accessible user interfaces is all really good, and it's some of it is frankly overdue, but it's what we've got. And the bottom line is that we're gaining greater access to entertainment, to pop culture, which is vital to us being a part of society and being able to share in the enjoyment of watching a really good television show. Or going on Netflix right now and watching something that's as hip and cool as Daredevil or House of Cards that we never had access to before. So why don't we shift gears here and talk a little bit about ACB's legal advocacy and what we have been up to over the last really 6 or 7 months. There's two lawsuits that have been filed, as well as some other stuff that we continue to work on with companies that are sort of new and really challenging traditional transportation. So with us to talk about some of this stuff, actually all of it, she can talk about whatever she wants, frankly. is my boss, Melanie Brunson.
Thank you, Eric. For some reason, Eric doesn't think I've talked enough today. I do want to, though, give you an update on a couple of things, but I'd like to know first to make sure that this is coming through okay on the speakers. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you. These microphones, for different reasons, depending on the room you're in, are hard to tell what's going on exactly. Want to talk with you first about some legislative activity. Has everyone in this room heard of the Marrakesh Treaty?
Yes.
Okay. Is there anyone here who has not? Excellent. Because the Marrakesh Treaty is hopefully about to become a legislative issue for us. And I say hopefully because, as some of you already know, one of the things about treaties is that even if your diplomats support a treaty and sign the treaty and say this is great, that support has to be ratified by the United States Senate in order for the treaty to become officially operable under U.S. law. So we are engaged right now in an effort to get that treaty on the Senate's legislative calendar in hopes that they will act upon it before the current Congress finishes its business actually this year. For a variety of reasons, we're hoping that they will take action this year. However, what has to happen is the White House first needs to send a bill, a proposed bill, to the Senate for their consideration. And that's where the Marrakesh Treaty is currently sitting. There is an interagency council or coordinating group of officials from the White House and the State Department and the Patent and Trademark Office and the Copyright Office and I guess the Department of Education as well, all of whom have input into what the U.S. legislative proposal regarding Marrakesh will actually look like. So there is effort to get the treaty moving. Consequently, ACB has undertaken a participation in a coalition of organizations that are interested in working on this issue. And we are, as they are, we've all agreed as coalition members to undertake a letter writing campaign to basically educate senators and their staffers about the need for this treaty so that when the White House finally gets the proposal to them, they will be in a position because of information to move as quickly as one can hope for these days on the issue. So after convention, we are going to be circulating some template letters and asking all of you to contact your senators to take that language that we are going to circulate and make it your own and express your personal as well as your affiliates' support for the Marrakesh Treaty, because we believe that the more people and the more organizations around the country that express support, the greater chance we have of showing Congress that this is an important issue that they need to act on. It is our hope to begin this effort fairly soon after we get back from convention. So please be on the lookout for it. If you don't see a letter in your email, contact your affiliate president. If they don't have it, contact Eric or me or anyone at the national office, and we will make sure that as soon as it's ready, we share it with you. So keep on the lookout for that. Okay? Eric, what is your pleasure with regard to questions? Do you want to do all the questions at the end? Okay. I think we're going to hold all the questions till the end, and then we'll ask them. So make a note of them if you end up having questions on a couple of topics. I want to, while I have the microphone, talk with you a little bit, give you an update about some issues that are not strictly legislative, but are certainly advocacy related and I hope are of interest. Kim has talked about both of them some in her report on Sunday evening, but we have currently two cases of national importance that are before the courts as we speak. One of them involves a lawsuit that was filed on behalf of Eric Bridges and ACB. It was filed against four taxi companies in the District of Columbia because their drivers all passed by Eric when he was attempting to hail a cab and picked up a sighted gentleman who was less than 100 yards away. Now, the interesting thing about that transaction was not only their discriminatory activity, but the fact that somebody across the street was filming the whole thing. And it appeared on television news in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. So we participated in a sting that was filmed by a news crew. They were investigating discriminatory activities by Washington taxi drivers. They had done a series of these involving racial profiling by drivers as well as failure to transport people in wheelchairs. And both Eric and I participated during their investigation of drivers' treatment of people who use service dogs. What we discovered was that about half of the drivers passed you by. And so we filed suit against all of the companies who were caught passing Eric by. I did not have quite the same experience. Actually, mine was kind of funny because there was a gentleman who passed me by, but the sighted man down the street stopped him and he said, "Why did you do that?" And the guy figured out what was going on. He said, "Because I didn't want to be on television." And he came back and offered me a ride the second time. So, because he decided he wanted a redo. And so he picked me up and proceeded to take me to the wrong place. But since he picked me up, we didn't include him in the complaint. I'm not even sure at the moment. I can't remember what company he was from. But nonetheless, we did file suit against the drivers who refused Eric transportation. That case is in the federal district court for the District of Columbia. And we will be reporting to you as that case develops. We are also involved in another lawsuit against the United States General Services Administration, also known as GSA. Now, GSA is an interesting agency because they're the ones who are responsible for telling everybody else that they're supposed to obey Sections 508 and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, which are both all about how government websites and government programs are supposed to be available, accessible to people with disabilities. I won't go into all of the details, but we discovered that GSA is involved in a little bit of do as I say, not as I do. Because GSA has a website called SAM.gov, which everybody who is a federal contractor or a federal grant recipient has to register with every 2 years in order to get paid for their grant funding or for contract services that they provide to government agencies. Unfortunately, that website is not accessible, has not been accessible to people who use screen readers. And there are a number of federal contractors whose livelihood depends on both their ability to register with SAM.gov and to use a screen reader. Some of those contractors happen to be members of the American Council of the Blind. And they contacted us and said, I'm about to be in a major pickle because I make my living as a government contractor. My contract is about to expire, and that website won't let me register. When we contacted GSA, they said, we know there's some issues, but some of them we fixed and some of them we can't, and golly gee, we're really sorry. And so we said, well, how sorry are you? Are you sorry enough to see us in court? So that's where we are. And we are a plaintiff as well as the individual contractors that I just referred to. There is a lot of positive effort going on to discuss how to resolve the problems. And we are hopeful that we can see a good outcome, but we're not at a stage where we can talk about anything in particular just yet because we aren't sure whether we are going to end up having to go to trial or whether there's going to be a possibility of settling the case without having to do that. But we will be pursuing it until we are 100% sure that this website will be accessible and will remain fully accessible to people who use screen readers. And it is our hope that in so doing, we will send a very strong message to all of the other government agencies that still maintain websites that are not fully accessible to people who use screen readers and other adaptive technologies to access the World Wide Web. So stay tuned for further developments on both of those issues as we proceed. And finally, I just wanted to make sure that all of you know two things about our currency case. First of all, the General Counsel of the Bureau of Engraving and Printing will be speaking during tomorrow's general session. And I urge you all to pack the ballroom. Secondly, it's going to be interesting to see what he says because there was a lot of publicity just before we left about the Bureau of Engraving and Printing's announcement regarding the proposal for a newly designed $10 bill that will have the portrait of a woman on it for the first time. replacing Alexander Hamilton. There is a lot of speculation about who that woman is going to be, but the thing that people aren't talking that much about just yet, including the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, although they did mention it toward the bottom of their press release, is that on that same bill, per the court order in American Council of the Blind versus the Department of Treasury, there will also be a tactile feature on that bill. So that is, right now, the Bureau is saying that that will be completed around 2020. We shall see. And that's why I said I think that it will be interesting to see what he says tomorrow about the timing and if anything about the plans for the design of that tactile feature, because right now we don't know much more than what I just said about what the specific arrangements are going to be or are proposed to be, or even what the options are that are still under consideration for the design of that tactile feature. So, ladies and gentlemen, there is a lot still to look forward to in the way of legal developments on those issues, but I wanted to make sure that you had the latest and greatest information that we do have at this point, and I will turn the microphone back over to Mr. Bridges. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Melanie. So next, I thought we would venture into the arena of innovation in a, it's sort of a, whenever I hear WIA, I get the chills. I get like flashbacks. It's a hard thing, but you hear WIOWA and that almost sounds like fun. Like WIOWA, like you're going down a hill, a snowy hill or something, or you're potentially being pushed down a hill, I guess. But as I was referencing earlier, the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act was reauthorized last year. And as part of that, as you all are well aware, it deals with the Rehabilitation Act and some proposed changes to various aspects of programs and other initiatives that we care as a community deeply about. And over the course of the last probably 4 or 5 months or so, there's been an individual in the blind community that has really become a subject matter expert on the ins and outs of WIOWA and the proposed regs, and has really led the community in educating on this stuff, because the regs, and he'll tell you here in a minute, they're like a couple thousand pages or so of what was really, really entertaining reading. Not so much. But really important stuff that needed to be uncovered, discovered. Some of it was there plain as day, and some of the other stuff needed to be looked into. And within the last couple months, the American Foundation for the Blind has put on a teleseminar that I participated on, as well as our next speaker, to talk about sort of the general community response and how we should respond in a formal way through writing to the Department of Education. And then he and his organization put together sort of a draft template that the folks in the community could use when submitting comments, which is also very helpful because the Department of Education did not make it very easy for a regular consumer to weigh in, which was really unfortunate. Is that the White House calling? Anyway.
I always
love a grand. Yeah. It's the same ringtone as my wife. I was like, whoa, wait, she's not here. She's in Virginia. At any rate, it is my pleasure to introduce a colleague and a friend, public policy and advocacy manager with National Industries for the Blind, Tony Stevens.
There we go. How's everybody doing? I'm going to be the three B's, brief, brilliant, and be gone, so we can get in the Q&A and hear from the rest of the panel. What I'd like to do first off is thank Eric, thank Melanie, Doug Powell, Brian Charlson, Paul Edwards, and others. When NIB helped out and co-sponsored the call with AFB that Eric mentioned around the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act, and we thought that was a good turnout. But then as we got closer and closer to the deadline, more and more people began to hear about it and began to get concerned. So when we did our final call to go over the talking points that we were circulating on our conference call, and we were kind of basing our numbers because you have to pay for these conference calls on how many people and how many minutes you're on the call and yada, yada, yada. So we're kind of basing it on the other one. And then we ended up having 135 organizations call in representing blindness concerns around the country, which to my knowledge hasn't been done in a long time. It took 16 years to get WIA reauthorized and passed since 1998 when the Workforce Innovation Act or Workforce Investment Act was introduced and passed in Congress. It took 16 years to get WIOA passed. We felt like WIOA had got their driver's license and was a little bit reckless. And we really felt specifically around people who were blind that there were going to be serious ramifications. Our 94 nonprofits that I represent up on Capitol Hill in the work I do, because you know NIB, we're employment focused and workforce development focused. So we've been looking to WIOA for a long time. So as soon as that dropped, they managed to drop it right on Holy Thursday, right as Passover is starting and Good Friday. So I had some time off and settled down with a nice cup of tea and some crackers and began to read and read and read, and before I knew it, no one else was reading. So by default, in a sense, I got the short straw. But you know what? Our nonprofits were concerned about the people that were going to be impacted. ACB submitted some comments that I think were very solid, and thanks to them, because you know our focus is on employment, and we believe that there's some things in this regulations that would seriously, inadvertently, but disproportionately impact people who are blind. Some of you might have heard about what's called the homemaker outcome, and that would be gotten rid of. Some of you had heard about the default to competitive integrated employment. And while the definition that was introduced in WIOA that then was sort of placed in through the regulations didn't really change anything on a paper sense, it's still between that and the homemaker outcome, we think really were huge hits on this idea of consumer choice. And the reality that people who are blind, as we all know in this room, have unique needs. And that's why we fought so hard over the years to keep our state designated units for the blind. That's why we fought to keep NIB separate from joining up with Source America and get grandfathered in there. That's why we fight so many times with like Randolph Shepherd and other things. Our needs are unique, and we believe that with the modifications that can be out there, we can really do anything, but we got to have the supports, and we have to have the experts and the people that understand the world to really help lift us up and become independent. So we felt that this could very much be a slippery slope, where if the number significantly dropped of outcomes, because the ratio was significant, particularly on the homemaker outcome, it was only 0.8% of people with disabilities were using this as an outcome. And basically what it is saying, okay, you might not be ready for a job yet if you're dealing with but you still need an important place to play at home, an important role you might play at home. It's the validation that homemakers are also significant parts of the family unit when it comes to work and employment and success. But then, two, oftentimes we would find at our nonprofits, like lighthouses around the country, that people might say, I can't see myself working yet. But after a few years, maybe. So they go in through the homemaker, and then later we'll become gainfully employed. So, you know, it was 0.8% for the larger disability community. It was over 10% within our community rely on this outcome. So it would have been a significant hit where, you know, if you're under the age of 55, if you're over 55 under Title VII, you can get special services. That wouldn't cover nearly the amount of services that you could get through getting an IPE and rehabilitation and going through the rehab process. And if you're under 55, but over the age of 24. And don't get me wrong, there are some things in WIOA that were good, and we recognize that. And it was a legislation that really, for youth, when I think back to how I was as a youth who was blind growing up, there's so many things in there that I wish I had. And there's a 15% set-aside for youth. If you're a youth that needs supported employment, you know, the real services, 50% of the allocated money towards supported employments are going to go towards youth. So there's things in there that are good for the kids. But at the expense of older age adults, and we know with blindness, we are trending very much for the next decade in the 40s, the 50s, particularly with minorities, groups of people of color, where diabetes, glaucoma are significantly more prevalent in your 50s and early 60s and 40s. While you're still trying to work these interventions, they need to be there. So we, again, were very, very thankful and somewhat surprised by the messaging that came out. We're going now through the comments. You can go online to regulations.gov. I will say there's the irony. Eric mentioned it. We had a number of people calling me the day comments were due, frantically panicking because they couldn't get them submitted. It's not the most accessible website, ironic, that we're posting on accessibility and how things need to be accessible. Under the Rehab Act, which gave us Section 508 and 503 and all these other things, you know, and here we are not able to post our comments. So a sense of irony in that, but nevertheless, you can go online, and that part of the website is a little bit more accessible where you can download comments from agencies. We had a significant turnout of people. We hope that messaging is going to be heard from RSA. Janet Lebrecht, obviously, who's the commissioner, understands our issues and knows our issues well. We hope that resonates through the rest of the administration and the Department of Education so that we feel that there's not this disproportionate impact to people who are blind. So if anybody has any questions about it, because the process isn't over yet. We don't know yet when the final regs are going to be issued. There's also what's called the WIOA Advisory Committee for Increasing Competitive Integrated Employment with People with Disabilities. That's meeting a number of more times. They're having a meeting in Washington this Monday and Tuesday I'll be at. They're focusing more on this competitive integrated issue, which is predominantly encamped and entrenched in the intellectual and developmental disability community, although we do know that people who are blind, and oftentimes for the younger folks, they all might be, you know, unfortunately have multiple disabilities and fall under this as well. So we're continuing to watch that. They're going to have four more meetings after this one where they're working on recommendations that will be sent back to Congress. The final regulation, we're thinking maybe after the – I can't imagine it personally after this year. You know, sometime this year, they received several thousand comments. I figured it was fair justice since they gave us several thousand pages. Depending on how you counted it, it was 2,600, depending on what format you were reading it in. So, you know, we hit them up too with comments across the disability community. So, but if anybody has any questions, we obviously will be monitoring it. We're continuing to engage through back channels, as is those of us that meet in Washington. There's a group of us, Eric and myself, Mark Reichert and others, that get together as blind advocates and go over policy. So we're working on that. And hopefully we'll be able to update you guys more as we sort of get any sort of intelligence on how this has been impacted, how it's been received, and then where we're going to go through the final regs. So happy to answer questions offline afterwards. Thanks, everybody.
Fantastic. Well, I thought we would end the afternoon on a fun and interesting note and talk a little bit about advocacy in the states and how special interest or state affiliates can do effective work. It sounds like Christmas in here. The The individual that I've asked to come and speak is somebody that I've known ever since I came to work at ACB and have worked very closely with her on the Environmental Access Committee for many years that she chaired, and most recently the Special Education Task Force that she's chaired for the last year or so, and have had the privilege actually to go and participate at her state affiliate convention. Actually, it was the first affiliate convention that I was invited to go to after I joined ACB, and it was a lot of fun. It was an eye-opening experience. They had me doing about 800 things, which was fantastic. But to talk a little bit about the relationship, you know, building and maintenance and all of that with members of Congress and other elected folks. And how her state affiliate does this is my colleague, and I like to thank friend, Debbie Grubb from the Florida Council of the Blind. Welcome, Debbie.
Thank you.
I feel very humble standing up here because there, just about every one of you in the room could be here doing exactly what I'm doing, and many of you, I'm sure, could be doing it better. But since Eric asked me, I'm going to do Tony's three B's and do this to the best of my ability. The first piece of advice, the first thing I learned when I began to do this work is this. All of us, especially those of us in this room, have very strong party affiliations. We do. We feel passionately about our parties, about what they stand for. Many of us work to see certain men and women get elected to office. However, you cannot have a good, fruitful, working relationship with your legislatures if you go under the assumption that your party is full of angels of sweetness and light, and the other side is full of devils who hate everybody, and that when they're in power, you're not going to get anything done. It doesn't work that way. And I have found some of my best work has been done with colleagues who, if I were in the legislature, would be on the opposite side of the aisle from me. So we have got to stop this. We have got to say that we have a right in this country to vote and believe as we wish. But if we set about to advocate for the rights of people who are blind or visually impaired, then I believe we have a moral obligation to strive to work with people on the other side of the aisle and treat them with respect, because when we do, when there are things we can agree on together and get work done, it truly is amazing. The second thing, my little pieces of experience that I want to share with you is this. The best way to have a good relationship with members of your local bodies is to develop good relationships with their legislative assistants, with their administrative assistants, anybody in their office. There's a couple of offices that I can call, and they even recognize my voice now. And so what, because here's the deal. This is also what I've learned. Most of the officials themselves, the senators and the congresspeople, they want to keep it smart and simple. They want a photo op. They want, you know, to hear you say how great they're doing. They don't want to sit down with you for hours and hours or for prolonged periods of time over months to talk about the details of whatever issue it is that you're bringing. If you develop good relationships with the people that they respect and that they will listen to, that is one of the big keys. A couple of years ago, we honored Gus Bilirakis, who of course is our in the Congress, but we awarded him because he
voted. He was one of the sponsors of the Medicare initiative that Eric has been talking with you about earlier in this session. But when he came, even I, jaded little old me, was a bit disappointed because he wanted to talk about how great he was. He wanted this to be about him. And he didn't want to answer any questions about, you know, I was all prepared to ask him questions about other initiatives that ACB has been working on and how we can better move toward a more fruitful relationship on both nationally and within our state. He didn't want to talk about that. So you have to build relationships with these people in very interesting ways. When I lived in Maryland, I met a senator, and she fell in love with my guide dog, who was a little golden retriever named Libby Bird. He weighed about 45 pounds. And she always liked to talk to me about Libby Bird, and I learned all about her dog, Sydney. And I want to tell you that I was happy to talk with her about Sydney, because eventually we could talk about things that were important to me. And I remember one day we were talking about some initiative that we wanted to happen, and we were speaking before her committee, and there was not time for all of us to give our testimony. But as I always do, I had written out my testimony and had submitted it according to the process. And so when I stood up for my 30 minutes of fame on the floor, the senator said to all of her colleagues, "I want you to read her written testimony. It's really great." So you have to find little hooks and little warm ways to get to know these people. And then when it comes to the nitty-gritty of the work, what it is that you want and what it is that you need, that is when you begin to speak and build relationships with the people that they have surrounding them in their office. Now, we had a senator in Florida, who was on the opposite side of the aisle from me. And at times, he really got on my last nerve because he was kind of full of himself. Thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread, and he was the president of the Senate until he termed out. And then he took a job with the Manatee County. He became the Manatee County Supervisor of Elections. Now, why am I telling you this? I called him up, and I spoke with his administrative assistant, and she said, "If you will write him a statement and email it, I will make sure that he reads it." So he called me up, and I was out when he called me, left me a voicemail, left me his cell number, and I called him up. And when I spoke to him, he said, "Now, are you still causing trouble?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "Good." Well, at the last meeting of our local chapter in Manatee County, we got to meet with the assistant supervisor of elections, the person who really does most of the work. And we are beginning to move forward with some very meaningful ways to ensure that we get to leave the touchscreen systems that are wearing out and are not allowing us to have a truly independent, separate ballot. I mean, you know, ballot that looks like everyone else's. So you do these things, and it is astounding what can happen. And what I will also say is that it is important to realize that these people don't have a lot of time. So when you meet with these administrative assistants, when you meet with the LAs, if you say, "I would like an appointment to talk with you about XYZ, but I will be happy to email you a summary so that we can make better use of your time." It is astounding how well that works. And what I also want to say that there are two things that are our greatest enemies in forging meaningful relationships with members of our state legislatures. One is, among our membership, apathy. And I'm sure all of you have seen it. We get out there, we work so hard, and sometimes it's difficult to get people to make a phone call or write a letter, and most blind people are ready to call anybody, unless you ask them to call somebody about a political issue. And so, you know, I mean, it's true. So what I'm going to say to you is, when you go home, you have got to at least get some of your members. What I ask our members is, what I have found is, and I'm sure Eric and Melanie and Tony and every one of you in this room, if a congressman or a representative or someone in your state legislature knows one of us, it's like 10 hurdles have already been jumped over. So I always say to people in FCB, for which member of our legislature are you going to be the face that they see when we contact them and the voice that they hear? What person are you going to be that face and that voice for us? And I think that that is extremely important. The other thing that I tell our members is, you know, we as people who are blind and visually impaired, pretty much, even though it can be inconvenient and annoying and expensive, if we want to go out with our friends or we want to go to a ball game or whatever it else is we want to do, we pretty much find a way to do it. Now, we don't have to go to the polling places all that often in the big scheme of things. And what I always say is, we need to be seen in numbers at the polling places. When we met with the Manatee County Assistant Supervisor of Elections, he told me, us, that out of all the accessible voting equipment, antiquated and not good at this point, but we still need to use it, that only 5 of us used that equipment in the entire county. So, you know, part of this, it's like Eric was saying, I can't do everything from Washington, D.C. You and I can't do everything. So, in summary, what do? We build relationships with the people whom our legislatures trust and respect and with whom they surround themselves. We try to find ways to make ourselves known to these people by asking our members, please call, please send a note, please go to a town hall meeting, please be that voice, please be that face, please be that person. And, you know, I tell everybody, and when I wrote my piece to Senator Bennett about our voting woes, I said, I'm not saying that we would ever advocate for doing away with the absentee ballot. But what I'm going to say to you is it cannot be the answer for people accessing the ballot, especially with today's technology. So whatever it takes for your chapters, if you make a day of it, meet someplace, invade the polling places together, get groups together, we have got to be seen voting. We've got to be seen as a voting block. If ever someone in your legislature does something good for you, publicize it. Do a press release. Make sure they get a copy of it. Because even if it's a fast news day and your little blurb of publicity doesn't get out there, they will see it. They love that. So what I'm finally going to say is this, that sometimes it's not as easy as you think. And sometimes it's disappointing. And sometimes you think these people are pretty surface. We have in Florida what's called a vision caucus. And unfortunately, most of the people are on it because they think it's the right thing to do. But we can't always get them to see the issues with which we are grappling. Right now, there are several that we are terribly concerned about in the state of Florida. But we keep trying. But being apathetic, not getting out there, not reaching out to these offices and calling these people, that doesn't get us anywhere. So I urge all of you as leaders in your own affiliates, lead by example. And if you have to lead someone by the hand to come with you after you've done the legwork, do it. Please do this, because what we all know is many times members of state legislatures become our representatives in Washington, D.C. And many times initiatives start in states. So what I'm going to say is, even when you get a good relationship with a legislature, a legislator, a senator or a representative or whatever they happen to be called in your state, usually the detail is not with them, but it does work. Sometimes it's slow. Sometimes it's annoying. But what I've seen is it's really the best way to get it done. And I urge you all to do it, and I don't think you'll be sorry. And I'm sure that many of you have. So keep it up. If you've done it, keep on the path. And if you haven't, let's all get on the path and start marching together to state legislatures and their assistants and their administrative assistants and their LAs, and let's get this done. Because if we all do, we can. So thank you for giving me this opportunity to share what little I have learned over this process with you. I appreciate it. And thank you, Eric, for asking me.
All right. So here's the thing. We're essentially out of time, guys, but all the folks will be up here at the front. If you've got questions for them, please come forward. But would like to thank you all for coming today. Hope you found the information useful. And please don't hesitate to reach out to me with any questions or concerns you might have about any of the legislative or regulatory information that we've covered today. Have a great rest of your convention.